Hello, everyone, and welcome to Sustainability as Strategy, a podcast brought to you by the experts at Roland Berger Americas. My name is Sean McMahon, and today we're going to be talking about Trump 2.0, tariffs, and the global energy transition. I'm joined for this conversation by Zach Kaplan, a partner at Roland Berger, based out of the Washington, D.C. office. Zach, how are you doing today?
Doing well. Glad to be here. We got plenty to discuss. You mentioned some really hot topics and enthusiastic on sharing some insights and having a good conversation.
Yes, I'm certainly excited to talk to you today. In a few minutes, we're going to get to the overarching policies of the Trump administration when it comes to the global energy transition. But I feel like, considering the headlines, we got to start with tariffs, right? So I should note that we're recording this on April 16th, 2 weeks after Liberation Day. And obviously, there's been a lot of back and forth, tariffs going on again, off again, different percentages. So Zach, what's your overall view on how the tariffs are being rolled out by the Trump administration?
Well, firstly, I think if we can take a step back and be a bit unemotional about it, and then we can be emotional about it and see and talk about impacts. But I think it's fascinating what's going on, regardless of where you fall in favor or not. But we are seeing a massive shift in economic policy vis-a-vis U.S. trade policy, with tariff being the weapon or the mechanism of choice to try to enact this in blunt force. So from an economic perspective, it's just interesting to be witnessing a change. And that obviously puts aside what the impacts, positives and negatives that we can break that down. So let's go ahead and we can talk a little bit about that as well. And what I'm seeing, firstly, like probably everybody else, is overwhelming sense of volatility. There is the daily update, if not several times a day, of shifting in what the tariffs are going to be and what they're going to do. And an overall question of what is the end game here? Is this really driving towards protecting American industry and trying to reshore and regrow aspects of our economy that have been hollowed out for the last 30, 40, 50 years? Is it about using it as a negotiating tactic to reestablish geopolitical ties? Is it about national security? And I would argue that it's all of those. I think it's all of the above, which is what makes it quite complicated to forecast and predict of where we land. But there are a lot of different impacts that we're seeing right now. And I think we need to be careful of how far into the future we say these impacts will be felt. So, for example, there's definitely the potential cost impact of the good that is going to be tariffed from whatever country. That matters in the energy space, for example, on supply chain equipment and things that we need for energy production, energy transmission, energy distribution. The input materials, whether it's steel, aluminum, concrete on big capital expenditure projects and new infrastructure projects. We're thinking of LNG export terminals. These tariffs will likely have an effect on the cost of those projects, given the cost of the inputs that are there. I think that we also see that the tariffs will have an impact on the ability to import or export our oil and gas, which is a key component of our energy development and our energy sector, our energy market in the United States. Not only on the cost side, but that's where the geopolitics will flow into it. Because if we don't have good trading relationship with a particular country, then they may not be so keen to buy our export, even if it's price competitive. So I think there's an influence on that as well. And then overall, what does this mean? I mean, we see it in the market, but you see it in the treasury yields. There's a lot of uncertainty, volatility with consumers and the market. You know, are we indeed facing, I wouldn't say as a result per se of tariffs alone, but we were experiencing or forecasting a potential economic slowdown moving into this year. Is this just accelerating that further? And you see a lot of the economists and the big banks and a lot of the forecasts around trying to predict the probability of a recession, for example.
Okay. And then, you know, based on your expertise and maybe, you know, what you're hearing just around the industry, what's the biggest surprise? And I kind of want to just steer towards like the size or the magnitude of these tariffs, because I think a lot of people anticipated tariffs somewhere in the range of 30, 40%. But, you know, suddenly, whether it's a negotiating tactic or not, we're talking about percentages much higher than that. So Has that kind of given people pause and kind of redo the math a little bit?
I think there are a few elements of the surprise factor that I'm feeling, but I think in talking to others in the industry and other economists and other folks looking at this, one is, as you said, the depth and the breadth of the tariffs, uniformly applying it 10% to every country, just as opposed to approaching this with more of a scalpel. It was much more of a hard hammer that came across, including those countries that we have favorable trade terms with. It's just a fair application across the board. I think that caught most of us by surprise. Secondly, is the speed at which they're going to be enacted, or we think. Now, we're currently experiencing the pause for a lot of it, but still there is the degree there that how quickly this will be implemented. Are our systems, and certainly are our supply chains, our value chains, markets, equipped to handle the speed? I would argue probably not to react to the immediacy of the enactment of it. And then the magnitude, to use your words, you know, at a certain point for me, I think it becomes a little bit silly, whether it's 125% or 140% on a particular thing. Essentially, what you're doing is you're stifling consumption or import or export of that good when you reach a magnitude that is that high. But still, coming out, I think that the ones that were announced on April 2nd were much higher than most expected them to be. And I think there was an expectation that they would be materially important. It wasn't just a nominal X percent, or, you know, a single digit percent just to make a point, but that they were going to be material, but not necessarily as extreme and aggressive as we saw it rolled out.
Yeah, I understand. It definitely was a sticker shock, if I could use that term.
Yes.
So you touched on LNG, and so I kind of want to dive into specific sectors within the energy industry and how you think they'll be impacted and what do you think their possible reactions or countermeasures might be. So be it wind or solar or, like you said, LNG, what are you seeing across each subsector?
I think it's varied across each one of those subsectors. And still, I'd caution with any level of perfect certainty of what we see. And then we can look at sort of, you know, what are the headwinds and the tailwinds for each one of those. But let's start with LNG, for example. I think the things that are promising for it is the opening up, and at least at the policy level, a favoritism and a warmth to using LNG as a source of energy and industrialization to try and bring down energy costs in the United States, stimulate more investment and development by making energy cheaper. However, we need to counter that with the overall market. If we are, in fact, walking into a recession or an economic slowdown or not nearly the boom that's expected, it doesn't matter if we have and are producing a whole lot more LNG if it's not being used or demanded. So that doesn't mean necessarily that all the major energy companies are going to be doubling down on production, exploration and production of LNG. I think we will probably see some of that with the independents that would factor into it, but I don't anticipate major movements with some of the major energy companies. Another factor with the LNG is the lifting of the ban of LNG as export. So we know that the administration wants to use this as a tool in its trade arsenal in terms of geopolitical negotiation and trade. That could be a positive sign for LNG exports and, you know, production overall, but assumes that we land in a place with a trading partner where they're willing to buy it, whereas other trading partners like China would ban it or put a tariff on that as well of very high proportions, which could reduce demand. So my takeaway there is it's uncertain. I think the same is the case more for transition technologies or the renewable technologies like wind and solar. I think that there is substantial enough of a market for onshore wind and certainly solar that the market will continue without government subsidies and support and top line policy support, where it will continue to grow and be installed, albeit perhaps some stumbling over the next couple of months until the market settled down just in terms of volatility. But things like offshore wind look to be very much paused at best for the foreseeable future as I can see it. Again, I'm grouping all of these things in because they're quite nuanced when you break it down at a state level and you look at state policies and various incentives, for example. I do anticipate that there will be a enthusiasm and more investment and a serious look around nuclear now and SMR. gas as well coming back in, coupled with CCUS, especially as we try to look and tackle some of the power issues around the data center and the demands that are going to be caused by those investments.
Are you seeing anything strategic that some of these sectors are doing to kind of brace themselves for these tariffs? And one example I saw recently was that how the solar industry imported, I think it was 50 gigawatts, something like that, of panels ahead of Trump taking office because they kind of knew that tariffs were coming. Are there any other sectors where you're seeing, you know, action like that being taken kind of proactively?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, there are a lot of mitigating actions in the short term that companies are trying to do in the face of the tariff uncertainties. For example, especially in fast-moving consumer goods or cheaper products that we, not in the energy sector, for example, but just things that, that we're very reliant on China, is trying to, I hate the perhaps use the word hoard those as quickly as possible, you know, to build up your inventory to hedge against the increased costs that are coming. I saw that also with solar panel. One of the issues that limits the ability to do that in the energy sector is that a lot, even before tariffs, there were a lot of ongoing supply chain bottlenecks that allow companies or developers to purchase in advance a lot of the equipment, whether it's transistors or gas turbines. You know, tariffs or no tariffs, there were serious supply chain bottlenecks that can't be overcome or accelerated given the other factors that are limiting the movement of those goods across international borders.
Okay, now you mentioned at the top how, you know, the implementation of these tariffs or the announcement of these tariffs, in most cases, there's a lot of strategy behind it. And one element of that strategy might be to onshore the manufacturing of these products and, you know, provide jobs here in the U.S. Is the U.S. ready to do that? Or how much lead time do you think we'll need to get those manufacturing facilities and those supply chains up to speed?
Yeah, so my sense on this is that there's a great underestimation of what it's going to take to deliver on the policy objectives of the amount of jobs and reindustrialization and new manufacturing investments in the United States. That is presumably the overall or one of the key objectives of these tariffs. Mind you that it's taken several decades for these industries to leave and for the global manufacturing base to step up and reorient. And so just by putting some tariffs in doesn't mean that we have an existing industrial base and a workforce skill set, especially if you couple that with some of the crackdown on immigration and undocumented workforce in various sectors, we could be pinching ourselves very, very thin on the assumption that we have a labor market that's ready. We have a labor market in terms of quantity. We have a labor market in terms of the right skills that we need to reshore a lot of these industries. We have the infrastructure and the power grid needed. We have the equipment ready and the capital behind it. So yes, you know, tariffs could, if we give the benefit of the doubt, that is ultimately one of the key policy impacts here. It's going to take time. And even with tariffs, there are other forces that need to be enabled in order to make this successful in the long run. So my sense is that what I'm seeing and what I'm reading, as we see with most politics, regardless of party politics and where you land, that there is an underestimation in the time and effort it will take to rebuild these industries or manufacturing bases across multiple industries in the U.S. I think there's an assumption that there's an existing labor capacity, just sheer volume of workers. And mind you, before tariffs were announced, we were already in a very tight labor market. We're putting more pressure on the labor market in different sectors with a crackdown on undocumented workers, which could have more of a squeeze in the labor. And do we have the right skills? A lot of the skill base that we need to work the jobs in manufacturing and industry that we're talking about have equally been lost over several decades as much of this stuff has gone offshore. In addition to which, we have to look at the power grid, we have to look at the infrastructure, the logistics in the country to still try to make these industries competitive, price competitive around the world. And so overall, I see that there is an underestimation in the timeline and an over-reliance or overestimation of what tariffs can do to single-handedly result in those policy objectives that we hear announced.
So we've spent a lot of time talking about, you know, the uncertainty going on here in the U.S. with all these policy announcements. But obviously the energy market is a global marketplace. So what are you seeing in other regions or other countries, you know, be it whether they're rattled or perhaps seeing an opportunity? What's your take on that?
I think there are some interesting dynamics that are playing out in other regions around the world as a result of the changes that we're experiencing here in the United States. Firstly, I think investor and consumer sentiment overall is down. And that's not me just saying that. If you just look at any of the stock indices around the world, whether it's the major ones in Asia or Europe, Canada, consumer and investor sentiment is depressed from where we started the year. It's performing below. And we shouldn't be surprised. We know that. And I think a lot of that is based on the uncertainty in an already fairly feeble market coming into 2025. And that's important. That should not be underestimated because that's the driver behind any investment. The second thing is when we look specifically at the sustainability and sustainability vis-a-vis energy space, I think we're seeing a playing out in various regions of how countries and regional trading blocs are going to pursue their own energy, continue and pursue their own energy transition plans. It's despite the efforts that we will continue to see on a global level and a multilateralism level through COP, for example, and Paris agreements but I think we're going to see, and we're seeing various countries and regions start to question what is our own commitment and how are we going to have our own pathway to continue energy transition that's not so dependent on a major economy like the United States. This may change in 4 years if there's a change of administration. It may be some variation of what we see today, or it may continue the pathway that we're experiencing right now. But I'm seeing more of a regionalization and with major economies, a country-by-country decision-making framework for policymakers now around sustainability, around energy transition. And I think that matters for businesses because it will be less of a global commitment that is uniform for a company around its energy transition goals and more of what are we going to do in the United States? What is our commitment and what is our play in the EU? What are we going to do in Asia, for example?
So we spent the first chunk of this conversation talking about tariffs and the impact those have had on the markets. But I want to step back a little bit to the beginning of the Trump administration, when he announced unleashing American energy as an executive order, you know, before Liberation Day and before all the tariff kind of stole the headlines. What are your overall thoughts on that executive order and just the overall mission of that aspect of Trump's policies?
That's very interesting as a policy decision and direction. Not wholly surprising from my perspective, but still merits a little bit of time to break down and try to understand what is the direction of travel, what is the purpose. I think we've been distracted for good reason, as you mentioned at the beginning of this question around tariffs. But we need to see tariffs as one piece of an overall policy redirection of this administration that's affecting sustainability, that's affecting the energy economics. So on the topic of unleashing American energy, I think firstly is a shift back to fossil fuels and an acceptance that there is a resource that the United States can leverage here for national security purposes, for geopolitical purposes, to monetize as a tool for trade. And I think that's one main objective here. So in these geopolitical negotiations and trade negotiations, using LNG and oil as a tool for bartering, as a commodity that can be traded for favorable tariffs or trade terms is one that plays into that. I think secondly is around the hope and the belief that increased production will drop costs, energy costs in the United States, which have continued to rise, make things cheaper from gasoline to also our energy at the meter cost, and hopefully stimulate more consumption and more investment in manufacturing and industrialization. Thirdly is playing into energy security, just being very, very careful and cautious to make sure that as the administration pursues what I'd consider to be economic independence from all other parts of the world, including China, that we are self-sufficient and have the reserves, the ability to have a closed system to pursue all of our energy needs and demands in the future. I think that it takes a stance on the face of it against some of the energy transition technologies. But I think in practice, a lot of those will remain in place because the market has already invested in them. The train sort of left already for some major investments on this, and there's a market for it. Some will be losers, some will be winners, but overall, I see if we can cut through the politics and the rhetoric of that executive order, I think functionally, and perhaps there's some optimism here, that a lot of our investments in energy transition technologies and renewable energies and climate-friendly technologies on energy generation will continue and will not be displaced wholeheartedly in a big way immediately by fossil fuel investments.
And with this focus on fossil fuels and, you know, other transition technologies, are there any other aspects that could either accelerate the unleashing of American energy or hold it back? You know, and I'm talking about permitting or tax incentives, things like that. A lot of stuff that was in the IRA, and there's uncertainty about it now. Will it stay or will it go? What's your read on that?
So I think it's a simple one to keep in mind when it comes to future investments or new investments in fossil fuels and oil and gas. You got to come back to supply and demand. And supply and demand not only in the U.S., but globally. And that's going to be the number one driver to whether and how and at what cost there's going to be more investment and more production from our fossil fuel industry. So let's not look for the most sexy answer in all of this when it does come back to how are markets faring and how are consumers consuming, and are we going for economic growth globally? Are we at status quo and a level playing field or a recession? But coming back to your point of the different things that are at play that are going to impact that as well, getting to the fiscal side of stimulus around fossil fuels. There are a couple dynamics at play. So we know that the tax credits, the loans, the grants that have been made available over the last couple of years through the IRA are at risk. I don't see that everything is going to be wholescale repealed. Again, what I was saying before is because there's now an industrialization and a jobs and an economic growth rationale around those technologies now and in the future. And there are a lot of livelihoods that depend on it. There's a lot of investments already taking place and should continue to take place that pulling those would be highly economically net negative, in my view. Forget the story about what it means for emissions and climate change. Secondly is we want to be careful because I think there is a recognition that these are important technologies and they tap into important value chains and supply chains like critical minerals. And if the objective here for the administration is to be highly economically autonomous and not dependent around other economies, we need to have the market and we need to have the investment resources and the enabling environment to continue to secure those supply chains and value chains and processing critical minerals, for example, which are used in energy transition technologies in addition to other applications as well. So we don't want to cut our nose to spite our face there. And I think that's a mitigating force. Also, we need power. And some of the renewable technologies can be installed and put in place much quicker than fossil fuel energy development and distribution and generation around that. Also for the supply chain reasons I mentioned, like gas turbines, for example. It's not as if they're lined up at the port and we can just install them tomorrow now that we are more favorable to LNG as a government, for example, or fossil fuels. So I think these are important things that protect some of that, in addition to investments in these technologies that could be used around the world. You know, just because we're looking at our own costs and our own generation mix in the United States, many large investors, institutional investors, as well as energy companies, see their market globally and need to have those technologies and those generating capacities and technologies that are appropriate for those other regions and those other places.
Do you see any political risk here when it comes to, you know, the tax incentives and loans? Because, you know, it's been widely reported that as far as the IRA is concerned, the majority of those incentives and loans went to congressional districts that were, you know, represented by Republicans. Right. And so rather than just a broad stroke of just rolling back all those loans and incentives, do you think, you know, to use the word you used at the top of our conversation, do you think there might be a scalpel suddenly used where factories and, you know, wind farms or whatever that are in red districts will be preserved, to use lack of a better word, whereas ones in blue districts, you know, those grants will be pulled back, or those incentives, you know, won't be honored.
I do. I think that the conversation and the ultimate place where we land is on how this administration continues to support these incentives that were originally made available through IRA. And mind you, many of those preceded the IRA. If we look at the Loan Program Office and its different names and iterations, has existed for a very long time before the Biden IRA. I think it is a much more nuanced conversation than a full-scale repeal of these for many reasons. One is what you already mentioned. The benefits of a lot of these and the investments that go along are going into Republican and MAGA-friendly places, loyal places politically. And there are now livelihoods and value chains that are becoming dependent on those. And again, pulling those back would have a socioeconomic impact, which would be net detrimental in my view. Secondly, is a lot of the support for the credits and the loans will come down to also how it matches up against other administrative priorities around emissions standards and changing regulations and permitting. Because as we said before, a lot of these work hand in glove. So for example, if we look at the production tax credit or the investment tax credits, for example, rather than a full-scale repeal, I think it's more likely that you're going to see criteria for qualification or timelines around when these will last to be more of a response than a cutting of them across the board. Now, some of those criteria or policy changes on how you can access and who's eligible for these or what timelines we're talking about when they will expire may push a lot of those who are seeking those away from the table because they're either too complicated, they no longer qualify. Maybe the energy communities that they could, that were eligible before have been redistricted or changed and make them no longer qualified. And part of that is the political side of things because it's not so black and white. It's not so partisan of who's benefiting from a lot of those. And so to play politics there, need to find a more graceful way to achieve the shift in policy without cutting off those who are loyal to your party, but also benefiting from a lot of the impacts, the good impacts, I would say, coming from these IRA fiscal support mechanisms.
Do you think the same kind of, you know, political lens will be applied to tariffs? Meaning, you know, right now we're talking about just broad numbers for any product from a country, whether it's 10% or 125%. But do you think, you know, to use the term again, scalpel, might eventually be taken to technologies, right? So that gas turbine, oh, we're rolling that tariff back to nothing or reducing it to 10%. But wind turbines and solar panels, we're going to keep those at 100%. Do you think there's political risk there?
I do. And I think that it's going to result once we get through a lot of the shock and the upheaval and the volatility of this initial period. What will play out will be a lot more discussions and negotiations and deals, either with companies, with sectors, with associations that represent key elements of industries or individual countries around exceptions, around delays, around a shifting from quotas against tariffs, because I think otherwise the economic squeeze it will put by sector, by industry will be crippling. And so in order to ultimately achieve economic growth and prosperity, which I do believe this administration is trying to drive as quickly as possible, I don't think there can be so many places where you can squeeze and not release the white knuckles on the steering wheel, so to speak. And that's going to require these types of discussions, negotiations, exemptions, certain products, certain services, and discussions also around the use of non-tariff barriers or negotiating away non-tariff barriers, which I think right now are being lost in the conversation. Everything is all about tariffs, but let's not lose sight of the full chessboard here of what goes into trying to achieve the objectives. That's a very, very important piece, I think, that's missing right now in the conversation.
And speaking of that conversation, so we can't talk about policies without talking about politics. And when you talk about politics, the words we use matter. And so I'm wondering, you know, even a phrase like energy transition, it kind of, in the past 4 or 5 years during the Biden administration, it kind of implies we're transitioning away from fossil fuels and other technologies. Seems like politically that might not be the best phrase. Should we be talking about these terms, using a different kind of vocabulary when we talk about the future of energy?
Yeah, I think we need to. Whether we want to or not is a different conversation than whether we have to. And I think I'm thinking of this through the lens of business now, and not through the lens of an individual consumer or my own personal beliefs of what words we should be using and should be safe to use. It's clear to me, as I'd hope that many see, that there are words that are no longer acceptable and received if you want to cross that public-private divide right now. And I think there's an association with of sustainability, of energy transition, that goes back to the previous administration, for better or worse. Also factoring in things and links to DEI and inclusion and equity, energy equity. And these things just don't have a space right now in politics in Washington or an appetite. But it doesn't mean that they shouldn't exist. And so a pivot in the language we use, as you said, can matter. So I think a lot of the same activities and outcomes can be achieved, but using and thinking about words around energy independence, energy security, technology and innovation, R&D, if we want to secure, for example, critical minerals, which lead to battery technology, does that, and in the course of doing that, can we strengthen our ability to pursue clean technologies and energy generation better than we did a few years ago? Absolutely. Do I think a lot of that will continue? Yes. Will it be done under the umbrella of the main purpose of a climate change outcome? No, I think we're going to see it right now in this administration and in this environment around technology, independence, the need to secure that type of wherewithal and capability here in the United States.
I understand. And so, you know, we spent a good amount of time right now just talking about Trump 2.0. tariffs and the future of energy, not the energy transition, if you will. So if I'm a business owner or on the board of one of these businesses that is going to be severely impacted by some of these things, what should I be doing to mitigate my risk?
It's a great question. I like to think of it in three buckets of what can be done, and to inject some pragmatism here, because I have lots of conversations with others and with various clients and companies who say and are skeptical that anything can be done right now of any value because it's just too volatile, specifically if we look at the tariffs. We don't know. I don't know. I don't have an insider's view of where we're going to land with the negotiation with Japan or South Korea or the EU. But it doesn't mean that a sit and wait is a winning strategy either. I think there are some aspects in the first bucket, I would say, that you do need to sit and wait because we don't have the right information yet and it is too volatile. There are the other ones that the next bucket, which is the short-term mitigation actions, which you can hedge against price increases if you're looking at things, for example, on pricing mechanisms, on passing on various costs, on inventory management, which we had discussed earlier about trying to stock up in the case of liquidity planning for a business is really, really important, the volatility. And I think that businesses need to now strengthen atrophied muscles that may have existed in the past around building into strategy, planning, finance, a level of policy volatility in the United States that they didn't have to worry about in the same way in the past. Whether it's tariffs, whether it's a shift in other things, I think this volatility or a level of volatility needs to be accepted now into business planning, and then building up those internal capacities and the people who know how to plan this, look at it, forecast it, so that you are throwing off the front foot when a decision needs to happen and not being reactive. And then I think one of the most interesting to me, which is the longer term planning and activity. And before I talk about what that could look like for a business, I think it's important to put the why I say this. This gets into the larger discussion, which I've mentioned before, around the overall development trajectory that I think we've been seeing in the last 10, 15 years, and why tariffs are not wholly shocking to me as a tool to do this, which is we've seen that there has been a shift globally away from hyper-globalization and free trade to regionalization, localization. I'll give you an example. The Economist had a really nice article back in May of 2024. I don't know if I have the title right, but it had to do with, quote, deglobalization, unquote. And it was quite interesting, even this is before Trump, before tariffs, before Liberation Day, before Inauguration Day, all of these things, which was saying, if you look at the indicators, we're moving to a world pretty rapidly of less movement around free trade. Countries looking at their own independence and economic independence and autonomy and building their own industries back up for lots of different reasons. I'd argue that this started in 08, 09 after the global financial crisis with a winding back of such easy and free flow of capital. And that was accelerated under COVID, which scared a lot of countries to say we can't be dependent on foreign manufacturing bases for N95 masks. And we can't be so dependent on other economies. If that economy gets a cold, we can't suffer getting the flu. So you see that between 2021 and 2022 or so, there were almost 1,500 thereabout, according to this article, industry protection mechanisms that were put in place around the world. In the early 2010s, that figure was close to zero. So it indicates, and this is an area that I study and work on and advise on around local content, localization, industrial policy, which is a term that we wouldn't have used openly without being embarrassed 5 years ago. But that's in everyday parlance now in this conversation. And so I think that we're seeing an acceleration of this under Trump, with tariffs being the tool of choice right now. Not necessarily the right one, or not necessarily being used or exacted in the most optimal way. But I don't think we should be surprised and feel that that 2025 marked a U-turn in where the world was headed. I think it's a continuation, and perhaps the slope is getting a little bit more steep on its curve, but it was there. And I mention all of that because the long-term planning, the more structural corporate transformation thinking that needs to be done is for companies to be realizing and accepting that Trump or no Trump, 4 years or another Republican administration in 4 years or a Democratic one, I think the macro trends here for the foreseeable future is around investing and managing your businesses within a region and even specifically within particular countries like the United States, and setting your strategies around that with a lot less dependence on the flow globally that we've seen. And I think that needs to be thought of regardless of whether the tariff is at 50% or 20%, or even if the tariff drops to 0%, because the other forces at play, non-tariff barriers, consumer sentiment, climate change, national security, all of these things are playing to a much more localized view of markets and localized view of investment and production. So to sum it up, I think that we can put decision-making into three buckets. The first bucket of decision-making is the wait and see, the activities that we don't know. We don't have enough market information, and it would be too premature without that information to make decisions. The second is the short-term mitigation aspects of what can be done around examples like inventory management or liquidity management, looking at how to pass on costs or shoulder the costs that are happening in the short term from the changes. And the final one is the long-term strategy, strategic planning, corporate transformation concepts in order to reorient your business to what I believe is the new norm that will carry through in the future around localization, regionalization.
So I like that. I like having three buckets that business leaders can focus on to develop their strategy. Now I'm going to turn that question around a little bit. Are there any surprises out there? Are there any blind spots? Anything that might be lurking that business leaders should know might present a risk?
I think related to my concept of these three buckets around decision-making and what actions to take are three main potential blind spots for business leaders and decision-makers. The first one is to believe that this is a temporary status quo. And what I mean by that, and I mentioned it before, is that I think business strategy has to be recalculated and reformulated around a much more regionalized and localized view. And so it's not just, as I mentioned, the tariffs are symptomatic of a much, much greater force that's at play that preceded this administration, and I think will continue onwards into the future. So don't underestimate those macro level forces of what it means to operate your business. Secondly is, while overwhelming and interesting and tantalizing in many ways to track the tariffs on a minute-by-minute basis, don't overlook the full chessboard. There are a lot of other policies and activities at play, non-tariff barriers, whether those are quantity restrictions, exemptions, customs procedures, government procurement requirements, currency devaluations and manipulations that are very important to track on what they mean for the cost of your business, the cost of your products, ability to move, your supply chains, ability to operate and deliver your product or your services to your clients, to your beneficiaries, to your customers. And so don't lose sight of that. Look at the full chessboard of what's at play and be aware of it all. And the final thing is, I don't think this is a blind spot, but I'd emphasize it as the top, which is how geopolitics are playing into this. This is not just a story of trade policy and domestic economic development. Geopolitics are highly playing into the decisions around what this will look like. And so be paying a lot of attention, doing the right analysis, and looking at how those will influence business decisions vis-a-vis tariffs, vis-a-vis other non-tariff barriers, vis-a-vis trade, reputation, branding. A lot of that is really, really important and will have an impact on the success of your business.
Okay, well, Zach, listen, I've learned a lot just talking today. I really appreciate your insights and your expertise. So thank you for joining me for this episode.
A pleasure to be here and really appreciate the time to share some thoughts.